From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Bedraggled but upright, seven American POWs were rescued in Iraq on Saturday. Their 21-day ordeal has captured the hearts of the American people, and news of their release brought tears of joy and a collective sigh of relief. Now, they've begun their trip back to the U.S., and at some point, they'll be joined by the rest of the troops. Tonight on Point, the psyche of the soldier, what American troops will carry home from this war, and the country's responsibility to those it asks to fight. We begin with a look at the next phase of intervention in Iraq. Pentagon officials said today that major combat operations appear to be over. U.S. troops have taken control of Saddam Hussein's provincial home of Tikrit. Now the U.S. military's attention turns to cleanup operations and keeping order. Joining me from Washington is John Diamond, Pentagon correspondent for USA Today. Good evening and welcome, John Diamond.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. So talk to us about the corner that the Pentagon is describing being turned here.
It definitely appears that the heavy combat phase is over. Two of the aircraft carriers are on the way home. Some of the heavy bombers that were running daily missions are returning to their bases in the U.S. The military activity that's increasing is boots on the ground, more troops coming in, not for major land battles, but for the job of occupation. It's a huge country, and it, as large as this military operation was, involving some 300,000 U.S., British, and other allied forces, those people can be spread pretty thin when you put them in a country the size of California.
How many U.S. troops are actually in Iraq now, John, and how many are expected to be there as this boots-on-the-ground kind of occupation or transition, whatever you like to call it, comes into full flower?
The most recent figure I heard was in the vicinity of 85,000, but that may be about to jump by about 8,000 or 9,000 as that unit, the 4th Infantry Division that we've been talking about now for a couple of weeks, finally makes its way into the country and moves its way up to Tikrit. And I think the last time we talked about that, those troops, we were talking about them engaging in the Battle of Tikrit. Well, now it's all over. The Marine Corps moved in with relatively little fighting, and they are simply going to hand off to these 4th Infantry Division troops now moving north.
How many of the troops who have fought the war in Iraq, John Diamond, will come home and be replaced by others, or what portion are going to have to stay for weeks or months and keep the peace post-war?
Well, there's going to be a rotation schedule, but often these deployments are on something on the order of a six-month rotation. So individual units that have the toughest jobs or are in dangerous situations might rotate out of those dangerous situations on, say, a weekly basis. But the overall organizations, they can be expected to be out in the field 6 months before they cycle home.
And as for combatants who did see heavy combat in this war, when might they expect to be heading back to the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there'll probably be some rotations for rest and relaxation, some substituting out of units. I'm not really sure what the rotation schedule is, but what the United States now has is a fairly limited sized army of under a half a million to cover all of the U.S. military commitments around the world. Mm-hmm. And so troops, when the United States occupies a country, as is happening now, the troops who were assigned there can expect to stay there for a while. So there will be some cycling out. I can't tell you I know the exact rotation schedule, though.
So there'll be some homecomings, but they'll be spread out over a long time,
right.
It sounds.
It's certainly not the sort of the World War II analogy of one big grand parade, or even the Persian Gulf War, where once it was mission accomplished, everyone could go home. This isn't an occupation in a country whose institutions have at least temporarily broken down. And so there's going to have to be a force presence for a while a new government gets set up, and that is already starting to look like a very messy process.
John, are there still fighting tasks to be addressed?
Yes. The operative phrase at the Pentagon is pockets of resistance. And again, if you're the Marine or the trooper getting shot at, that diminutive term doesn't really quite capture it. But yes, there are incidents of sniping. There is the potential for acts of terrorism. There seems to be virtually no organized resistance at all. But as the U.S. military has found elsewhere, such as Khobar Towers or the USS Cole bombing, these more terroristic-like threats can be the ones that really hurt you.
What about on the POW front? We've all seen the images today of those seven POWs released. Are there more POWs? What's the status?
Right now, there's the casualty list is 118 Americans killed in action, four missing, and 400 wounded in action. None are listed as POWs, although those four missing, I suppose, could turn out to be prisoners somewhere. But the Brits have listed 30 killed in action. I don't have the missing there. I don't believe there are any British POWs.
So what is missing in action likely to mean in this conflict?
Well, missing in action means a unit or individuals were lost in combat, but they have not turned up anywhere, at least in terms of the other side saying, we've got prisoners. Those that were listed as POWs were put on the list once they appeared on TV or it became clear from some sort of communication from the Iraqi side that they were being held. Of course, one of the downsides of the complete evaporation of Iraqi organized resistance is there is no authority on the other side to communicate
with. No one to ask.
With.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's no one to check in on the formal status of those missing in action. John Diamond, thank you for joining us tonight.
You're very welcome.
John Diamond is Pentagon correspondent for USA Today. He joined us from Washington. No matter where Americans stand on the war with Iraq, there has been a remarkable outpouring of empathy for U.S. troops ordered in to do the fighting. They look so young and dutiful, doing the dirty work, whether they like it or not. This weekend, the nation cheered the rescue of seven POWs. They, along with POW icon Jessica Lynch, will be returning home to the U.S. soon. And eventually, they will be followed by tens of thousands of newly minted Iraq War veterans. The war has been short, but it has been sharp. Many soldiers have had their first experience of risking their own lives and of taking the lives of others. Ordering young men and women into combat brings grave responsibilities to a nation on many fronts, not least the responsibility to face the reality and challenges of returning warriors. Jonathan Shea works with U.S. combat veterans suffering from severe post-traumatic stress disorder. He has devoted his life to those veterans and understanding their place in the culture and community that sent them to war. In this hour, combat trauma and community responsibility. Is part of understanding war, understanding its impact on men and women who fight it? And what does the country owe veterans of the Iraq War? How do we embrace soldiers without celebrating war? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Dr. Jonathan Shea, a psychiatrist and expert in chronic post-traumatic stress disorder. He is the author of the acclaimed Achilles in Vietnam, Combat Trauma and the Undoing of Character, and his most recent book, Odysseus in America, Combat Trauma and the Trials of Homecoming. Good evening and welcome, Dr. Jonathan Shea.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. Not least because... We can just about feel the nation's mind now turning to the notion that these soldiers will eventually come home. I suppose every war is unique in its own ways. This one I have found as an American of a certain age who saw some of Vietnam and the response to that. This one has been remarkable to me for a war that on the one hand was very controversial. Ended up with majority support, but terribly, deeply opposed by many. On the other hand, there's almost no one that you can turn to about the troops who doesn't say, it is our responsibility, our moral obligation to support these troops, given that we've ordered them out there. I was reading last week in the Wall Street Journal about Marines already gathering in the battlefield to talk about the trauma of killing and begin to process that, begin to think about coming home. You've put this in your most recent book in the context of the great classic saga of Odysseus. Why did you choose that, and what's the context? How should we begin to think about the challenges of homecoming warriors?
The person coming home from war has an enormous chasm to span to return to a civilian life. Civilians seem so preoccupied with trivialities after they've come home from life-or-death situations. I am delighted, frankly, that the American public isn't going to make the same mistake twice about confusing the war with the soldier, and that they do now recognize that all soldiers in modern times serve under constraint. They don't get to vote on the justice or the wisdom of the war. So there won't be the kind of indifference and hostility that some people met on their return from Vietnam.
You turn in your most recent book to the great classic saga of Odysseus. Why there, and what are you drawing from this ancient wisdom of the Greeks?
Okay. In the Odyssey, there is this remarkable scene where Odysseus has wiggled his way into this very wealthy and complacent court of the Phaeacians. Odysseus has arrived buck naked on their shores, and he has lost his whole flotilla. He's lost his ship. He can't get home without their help. He needs them 100%. And he discovers that they are the quintessential civilians. They love downy beds and warm baths and dancing and music. And in fact, even war stories are just all entertainment to them. And because he needs them absolutely, he, I think, decides that he's going to give them what they can take in. He discovers immediately that they cannot listen with their heart. They cannot take in the pain of the real war story. And it's just typical. It's an amazing moment. The king of Phaeacia turns to Odysseus after he's identified himself finally. He turns to him and says, well, tell us about the war. And then before Odysseus can even open the mouth, the king says, oh, well, that was all the gods doing. It was to make a song for men to come. Now, that's a kick in the stomach when a civilian tells a returning soldier or marine or sailor or airman what the meaning of it all was before ever listening to them.
And is really ready to move right on to the next show on television or the next ballad in the court of Phaeacia.
That's right. The key thing is to be willing to listen and listen with emotion. Now, certainly no one who has a family member or a friend who's returning from the fight in Iraq should pressure this person to, well, tell us all immediately entirely what it was like. What was it like to kill somebody? This absolutely turns the stomach of a returning veteran.
And even so, you say that one of the most important elements here is the communalization of trauma. That is, somehow the community taking on board the reality of the warrior, the killing that's had to be done, the trauma to humanity that the warrior has undergone.
Well, this is a complex issue. The most accessible and valuable community that a returning soldier has is his own surviving comrades who were in the fight with him.
Because they know.
They know. They were there. And I believe very strongly that we're missing the boat in not strengthening military unit associations and offering them peer offering volunteers from them, peer counseling
even
training.
Even post-war, you mean keep these pods together
pre-war
somehow.
Pre-war and post-war. My image is somebody joins, say, the 1st Marine Division from boot camp and infantry school, that they should be met, and often they're married. Both of them should be met by the 1st Marine Division Association. You're one of ours.
Jonathan Shea, you've got some big ideas in here. You say the prevention of trauma lies squarely in the realm of justice, ethics, and recognition of one another's humanness. We want to come back and talk about that. We want to give these vets the right homecoming, and yet, as you say at the same time, not make it a celebration of war, rather a celebration of what they have offered up. We're talking tonight about the psyche of the soldier, what America's troops will carry home from war, and the country's responsibility to those young soldiers is part of understanding war, understanding war's impact on the men and women who fight it. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the psyche of the soldier, what America's troops will carry home from war, and the country's responsibility to those young soldiers. My guest tonight is Dr. Jonathan Shea. He's a psychiatrist in the Department of Veterans Affairs Outpatient Clinic in Boston. His patients are generally Vietnam combat vets with severe chronic post-traumatic stress disorder. He has also written in great depth, most recently in Odysseus in America, Combat Trauma and the Trials of Homecoming. You can join this conversation as well. What does the country owe the veterans of the Iraq War? And does taking responsibility for war mean we have to listen to the hard stories, the nightmares of the soldiers who fight it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jonathan Shea, I want you to speak to this. It's a large point you make. I'm trying to fully take it on, but saying the prevention of trauma, and you mean combat trauma here, lies squarely in the realm of justice, ethics, and recognition of one another's humanness. These are not exactly factors we associate necessarily with war. What do you mean here?
Okay. What I mean there, first of all, is in the qualities of our own military institutions. The trustworthy properties of community in the face-to-face unit, the positive properties of community, and stability is essential for that. When you brought in the Washington correspondent, I was chomping at the bit to ask, well, will they be bringing people home as units, or will they be bringing them home one by one by one?
And you want them as units because once they atomize, their support system is gone.
Exactly, exactly. The one thing we must never do again is send people into battle alone with strangers and bring them home alone in plane loads of strangers.
And when you say again, you're referring to Vietnam.
Vietnam.
The experience there being famously lousy.
Atomized and lousy. And that was a disaster.
I'm not sure people outside the battlefield and the military experience really understand what post-traumatic stress syndrome is. Are there still Vietnam vets suffering acutely after all these years? And Vietnam went on a long time. Can a 3-week war produce that trauma?
The POWs that were just liberated, most of them were in a unit that took a wrong turn and drove into an ambush. Then the deeper they drove into it, the worse the ambush got.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is quintessential. That is a basic kind of simple PTSD that they will probably relive that ambush in their nightmares and in their intrusive memories for, I can't predict for how long, but some of them it will be lifelong.
With what impact on their lives?
Well, that's the crucial question. Will it wreck their lives, or will it simply be a specific focused disability caused by the symptoms flaring up, say, on the anniversary of this ambush, or their symptoms flaring up in some situation, whether it's some smell or some sound that triggers the intrusive symptom?
But when it flares up, and we have these kind of cinema images of the anguished vet who just can't explain but is full of angst and some anger, even violence, is that a caricature or?
Well, the persistence of the bodily reactions and the memory trace into civilian life is a basic and very ancient biological phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And I refer to that as simple PTSD, or at least a piece of simple PTSD, which is the persistence into civilian life of valid phenomena and adaptations that go with a life-threatening situation. And that does not have to wreck somebody's life. It may give them a focused, specific disability, an inability, say, in the case of an infantryman, to tolerate being in an open space in a crowd, because that's setting yourself up
vulnerable
for snipers,
mm-hmm,
for enemy mortarmen.
Mm-hmm.
And even though rationally this infantry veteran may know there are no snipers and no mortarmen, he just has a non-negotiable fear of crowds in open spaces.
Jonathan Shea, you've described some of the things that the military can do to help minimize this, keeping unit cohesion before, during, and after wartime. But what about the rest of this big civilian population that has said during this war, we have a special empathy with these troops, whether we support the war or not? What can, what should society at large do to embrace, to support these troops?
Okay, the most important thing, say, that family members and employers can do is to educate themselves so that they are not misattributing what they're encountering. For example, a veteran comes back from war and the spouse is at home and waiting for them and expects an enormous outpouring of warmth, mm-hmm. and the veteran it may seem like an icicle. Mm-hmm. Now, that's part of the persistence into civilian life of a valid survival skill, to shut down all emotions that do not directly serve survival is a basic survival skill in a life-threatening situation.
So at a fundamental level, how can the family, the society, help them melt that ice?
Well, first of all, by not personalizing it. By not saying, you don't love me anymore, or if you don't care about me, I'm going to go find myself somebody who does. Mm-hmm. And you know, all of the awful stuff that can come up when someone that you expected to be warm is cold. So education is fundamental. The vet center system has some good literature for education of families. I believe the VA has some literature for the education of families. The National Center for PTSD has a website with good educational materials on it.
And there's more that you share right here in your book, and we'll get to it. But I want to turn and bring into our conversation, if I may, Michael Corrigan. He's a retired Navy commander who served two tours in Vietnam. He's professor of international relations at Boston University. He joins us from Falmouth, Massachusetts. Good evening and welcome, Michael Corrigan.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Michael Corrigan, you served two tours of duty in Vietnam. Can you describe your homecoming for us?
Well, I've got to say one thing. I had two very different tours. One was as a gunnery officer on a destroyer for about 6 months over there in the rivers and off the coast of Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And it was somewhat antiseptic in the sense that you were
distant.
Shooting at coordinates on a map and occasionally some return fire would come, but it was always ineffective. That was one circumstance, and that was in 66 and 7. More striking, and this, especially given what Dr. Shea had said earlier, in 1971, I was an advisor to the Vietnamese Navy, in fact, at their Naval Academy in Nha Trang. Mm-hmm. And before that, I'd had a full training period, which involved the survival, evasion, resistance, and escape camp, and learning the Vietnamese language and a number of other things. And I spent the whole year of 1971 working with Vietnamese on a daily basis. They were the people I shared an office with and getting very close to them. And I thought when I came home, I said, well, I've got a fix on the war that I was very much involved with the Vietnamese. And exactly what Dr. Shea said happened. People would say, what was it like over there? And before I could even open my mouth, if my friends wouldn't believe that, people would then tell me what it was like over there because they thought they knew.
They'd seen it on the news. They'd seen it in the movies.
They'd seen snippets on the news, and this time we've seen news 24/7. And I'm worried that some people think, well, gee, now that we've seen it,
we know all about it.
We know what it's like, and they should read Dr. Shea's book first, both of them, as a matter of fact, and then a little humility, saying we don't know what it's like. We've seen some pictures, but I just spent the last week abroad in France, as a matter of fact, and the war that was being shown on television over there is very different than the war that's being shown over here.
And of course, the one experienced by U.S. soldiers in the field is another thing again. Michael Corrigan, I wanted to ask you, I was really struck by this Wall Street Journal story last week that described young Marines still in the battle zone taking time out for informal group therapy sessions, and this being now Marine policy, that an understanding has grown that dealing with what they're going through and what they're doing as part of fighting war, which means killing and stuff that's not the stuff that is ugly, that experience can be better handled ultimately if they begin to talk about it just as soon as possible. They describe young Marines saying, I can't believe what just happened yesterday, or, the image of that human that I killed and is still frozen in my mind. This is not the image that came out of the movies in Vietnam of soldiers sitting around processing this before they ever came home. The image was everything bottled up and back they come. Is the military, does it have a new sensitivity to how to help soldiers deal with what they can and must do on the battlefield?
Yes, I think there is a lot of learning that has gone on and a sensitivity about the soldier or the individual airman or marine or whomever, a sailor, being alone. As Dr. Shea said, if you constantly shuffle a unit and replace people all the time, you don't get to know the people around you, and life-threatening situations, that can be critical. And even when you do have a coherent unit that has stayed together, the individuals in the unit, the men and women, need to know that what they're experiencing and what they see in very extraordinary situations and sometimes very depressing situations. Mm-hmm. You're involved in a unit where somebody just killed a civilian by mistake, but yeah, it's something that you all deal with. And you'll have a lot of emotions and feelings and concerns. And if you think you're the only one with those, you're going to keep quiet and think there's something wrong with you. And sitting around talking about it, as these Marines are doing, make you realize that the other people are feeling much the same as you are. And that's a tremendous help. Because if these people don't, for instance, read the Odyssey or the Iliad, or don't read the great literature of war, some of which is really quite good, most of it's trash, but some of it is quite good, they'll think they're the only ones thinking like that, and that can be very, very difficult for an individual to deal with.
And now we have Marine officers in the field quoted here as saying, the touchy-feely stuff, it's no joke. If you keep picturing this guy and you shot him in the head, you've got to talk about that. We're at 1-800-423-8255. U.S. soldiers will at some point begin coming home from this war.
Tom?
A war they fought at the nation's behest. And how do we help them with that?
Can I point out that I can recall vividly I was giving a session at the Amphibious Warfare School at Quantico Marine Base, and Lieutenant General Van Riper basically kidnapped me during the luncheon to hear me talk about prevention of psychological injury. And I said, General, why are you so interested in this? He said, it's simple readiness. If one of my Marines is injured, whether it's physically or psychologically, they're lost to the force. I want to know how to protect my Marines, in addition to their general cultural a commitment to taking care of their people.
But you make an even larger point than that, that there's an effectiveness issue, but there's also, you are ultimately, you call yourself an abolitionist, Jonathan Shea, i.e.
abolition
in favor
of
the abolition of war. And there's a full kind of circle here that I want to get to, but there's so many people who want to join us on the phones. I want to turn there first. Heath is calling from Butler, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Heath. You're on the air.
Thank you very much.
Good evening.
I had a question for the doctor. When we're trying to relate to soldiers coming back, whether they're friends or family members, and we're having a really hard time respecting the decisions that sent them over there to kill people, how do we still show them or tell them that we respect them, even though it just makes us feel sick and sad that they were even asked to do those sorts of things?
That's a bottom-line question, Heath. Jonathan Shea.
Well, in a just war, and that's, of course, the question that's weighing heavily on all of us, the point of fighting is to win and not to kill. And even in an unjust war, someone who fights skillfully and only attacking the legitimate military targets, that is, the armed enemy, and doing it to the minimum degree necessary to win is conducting themselves in a just way, even if the overall cause is not just and certainly not wise.
But Jonathan Shea, you've gone further. You've said that in your work over many years now, you've come to see that time and again, the military men and women are not the pro-war element. They're doing their job there, but they actually hate war very often.
The people that I know in uniform, and at this point I know a great many of them, who have actually been in war, hate it with a passion that I, as a civilian who's never been in war, will ever match. I am fond of saying, I've never once met a militarist in uniform. However, I've met plenty of militarists among civilians who seem to think that war is a grand entertainment.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Heath, are you still with us?
I am.
Is this beginning to get at the substance of your question?
I think it is. It's just, it seems really awkward to say to a returning soldier, you know, I just feel sorry for you. I feel sad for you. And it doesn't feel like that's really what they need to hear to feel better about themselves.
Yeah, Jonathan Shea, you hear it here again. I mean, there were plenty of Americans who supported this war. There were many others who absolutely disagreed with it fundamentally and did not and do not believe it is a just war. But yet Heath doesn't want to say, he doesn't want to further wound.
Well, it's essential to remember that all modern soldiers serve under constraint. They aren't free to say, as Achilles said in the Iliad, I quit. Now, when Achilles said, I quit, Agamemnon couldn't have him arrested any more than Westmoreland could have had the chief of the Australian contingent in Vietnam arrested. So you must, in terms of your own compassion, have to realize that modern war makes captives of everybody on both sides. You are not free to leave.
Heath, thank you for your call. Michael Corgan, I wonder if you can speak to that same issue. You came back from Vietnam.
Right.
Of course, many returning vets at that time got a very hostile reception because after so many years of protest, the warrior and the war were all bound up together and many people were unable to pull them apart. What did you, you must have known that. What did you want to hear? What would have been helpful to hear?
Well, I just, when people would talk to me about the war, I just wish they would have listened because so few did. The minds were made up, and it was actually bad from both sides. The people who were very pro-Vietnam War were insufferable, and then the people who were anti-war didn't feel that they'd been effective in stopping things, at least not in 71. Of course, ultimately they were. But that ineffectiveness was taken out on you, a very visible symbol right there. And for most of us who felt that being in the military under the circumstances of the age, that is the Cold War and so on, was a good thing to do for the country, also felt that, look, the country made a decision to go to war, and it's not up to us in uniform to challenge those decisions. My response was always, look, what do you want, a military that decides when it will or will not fight? That's a military out of control, and that's chaos, and that's the downfall of many a country. So that we wanted to hear that people could make the distinction between a process that sent us over there mm-hmm. and their involvement in it, and I didn't hear much of that at all.
But that sounds like the kind of democratic dialogue that ought to be there. We'll come back and talk about the link here with democracy. We're looking tonight at the psyche of the soldier, what America's troops will carry home from war, and the country's responsibility to those young soldiers. What does the country owe the veterans of the Iraq War? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking tonight about the psyche of the soldier, what America's troops will carry home from war, and the country's responsibility to those young soldiers. My guest tonight, Dr. Jonathan Shea, author of Odysseus in America, Combat Trauma and the Trials of Homecoming, and Michael Corrigan, retired Navy commander who served two tours in Vietnam and is now a professor of international relations at Boston University. You can join us as well. Many people who opposed this war have said they support the troops. Does that promise a more humane homecoming? And how do we embrace soldiers without celebrating war? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. David's calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Good evening.
Good evening. I just wanted to emphasize two things. I think that the comment about bringing them home together mm-hmm. Is so important. And it does two things. It allows them to the vets to deal with as a group the pain, the problems, and the issues, and not getting singled out.
because they're supporting each other. Do you have direct experience of this, David?
I spent 2 years in Vietnam. I was there for the Tet of 68, and stayed through 70.
May I ask you a simple question, David? You see how relatively short this war has been. Does that make you any less sympathetic to these soldiers, or is it all the same?
I think the fortune was in the speed with which it ended. I can remember an old Korean sergeant saying to me, who had served in the Korean conflict in his own country, saying, you know, Sergeant Gagne, you Americans, you play at this. You know, if you want the only ethical or moral war is a war that ends quickly. End the war. And, you know, by that time...
It was already long.
I had been there so long, it kind of all blended. When I came home, I came home alone. Get off the plane in Boston for the last time. I had come home a couple of times. But it was just, you know, I came home alone.
And was that, have you escaped that loneliness in the homecoming from war?
Sure. For me, I'm happily married. I got a great family. I got two kids that are wonderful. And, I can remember when Desert Storm broke out. I'd be driving down 128, and I would break into tears. I would just have to pull off the road. And it wasn't for me, I don't think. It was what I worried about for our troops. But
we hear the depth of that emotion, and I so appreciate you sharing it with us. It makes me want to... Jonathan Shea, if I may, to go right down this list of things that you offer up to society as kind of prescriptions for minimizing the anguish that can come with this. And David, I hope you'll stay with us. But you talk about safety, acceptance, value, and respect. Take us through some of those. I think people could use guidance here.
Okay. Well, first of all, we've got to make sure that our military institutions do right by the people that serve in them. So my mantra when I talk to active duty people is positive qualities of community in the face-to-face unit, cohesion, of which stability is essential. Train people together, send them into danger together, and bring them home together.
Don't treat them like atoms that can be just shaken all over the board.
They're not replaceable parts. This is the single most important preventive psychiatry recommendation, and it's not new with me. It's been since World War II. Mm. Second is competent, ethical, and properly supported leadership, and we tend to have subcompetent leaders.
You mean leaders in the field, in the battlefield?
Actually in the field, because they get bounced from billet to billet too fast to become truly expert at these perishable combat skills.
With the consequence that troops end up in circumstances that are more compromising to their
Absolutely.
Souls than they should be?
Well, to their souls and to their bodies. Psychiatric casualties and physical casualties track each other. Mm-hmm. So anything that protects blood will also protect spirit.
And then you write that democracy is deeply related to the healing and prevention of trauma. What does that mean?
Well, in ancient Athens, we can't even begin to imagine how highly militarized that was. And yet they managed to figure out a way to digest the pain and the fear and the anger of combat trauma, and they did that through various practices, such as the tragic theater. Americans hate tragedy, and we have to really pay attention to rebuilding an appreciation for and an appetite for tragedy.
If you're going to launch wars, you're going to create some tragedy.
Absolutely. And people who have unhealed combat trauma are disabled for democratic participation.
You write that the original meanings of both hero and holy include the dark, destructive side. That there may perhaps the origins of tragedy come with war. David, I want to turn back to you. Do you have – what advice would you share with our listeners about how to reach out to these soldiers that come home?
I would just say don't push them. I can remember the first – people used to look at me. When I came back, I went back to being a lifeguard in the summer and trying to get back into college. And I can remember the only person – everybody used to look at me like I was strange anyway, just because I was a vet. And people weren't – back in the 70s, it wasn't – you know, they always questioned whether or not how sane you were and whether you were trigger happy and all the rest of that stuff. And that's how a lot of us looked at the world, and they said, all right, how are they looking at me? But I can remember a little child coming up to me at the pool and saying, you know, did you kill people in Vietnam? And I had to think about that real hard, and I had to, you know, kneel down next to her and say, well, I had to defend myself. But you don't have to worry. You know, something like I said something to her, I remember, that said, you know, it's okay. You know, I'm okay. And I had just defended myself. But let them tell you what they want. If they don't, we found little groups that we could talk among ourselves. The VA was terrible back then. They didn't do much. I think they may have tried. But
David, I want to ask you and Michael Corrigan, Jonathan Shea, I mean, in the reporting from the field that I'm reading here, troops are talking with one another in a much more visceral way about what they've gone through and the reality of combat. And, of course, it is horrible. It is ugly. It sometimes requires shooting and killing humans who are on the ground but may still be dangerous. There are intestines and brains and, you know, horrible things that come along with this. I guess it leaves me confused about whether is it a society's responsibility to be open to those facts, those realities of war, once you launch war, or are those to be sublimated and treated with some kind of honorable silence?
I don't think you can understand them.
The chasm with civilians is enormous. It is just enormous. Mm-hmm. And I'm certainly not advising people to, quote-unquote, debrief their family members who've just come back from a fight. This is just foolishness.
Let them offer what they'll offer, in other words.
Let them offer. And remember that veterans returning from war understand secondary trauma. They have a very strong sense. If you knew what I knew,
it would hurt you.
It would hurt you. It would injure you to be witness to that through my narrative.
David, I want to thank you for calling tonight. I appreciate your coming on. Michael Corrigan, yes, please.
On this, we are talking about what the people can do who are back home, and that's the second book that Dr. Shea wrote. The anecdotal evidence I had, and actually from my own children in school, and I've heard it happening up at some schools in Maine in this war and so on, is that a lot of teachers of young children who you would expect teachers, I have a dislike of war just instinctively. Mm-hmm. In Vietnam era, many of them were people who chose that profession rather than serving, telling young children that war is terrible and therefore soldiers are terrible, and they're preparing the minds of young children, in fact, but sometimes the children of the very soldiers themselves, to have a very negative attitude toward people. I think that's one of the things we have to watch, that how impressionable young children can be.
And yet, Jonathan Shea, we've just got 40 seconds left here. But we don't want to raise war up as the goal. You're an abolitionist. You're opposed to war itself.
We can end this human practice of war. War is a state-sponsored activity, and we can end it, just like we ended legal public chattel slavery. It may take centuries, like it took centuries to end slavery, but we can do it. I'm not talking about ending evil. I'm not talking about ending individual violence. That's probably beyond our powers. But to end war, this we can do. And I find that professional military people have no trouble with that.
With that idea. And you quote the Talmud saying, you're not expected to finish the job, but neither are you free to lay it down. It's a responsibility. I guess in this compassionate understanding of war, you're seeing the path toward ultimately escaping it.
And it lies in trustworthy collective security.
Tom, just to add to that, we can learn not to do these things. Remember, people used to duel as a way of solving quarrels individually. We have learned over centuries not to do that anymore. People don't use that as a way of resolving differences.
But yet we can bring back those who have been ordered to go and duel in a way that leaves them with their humanity as intact as it can be. Michael Corrigan, I want to thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Michael Corrigan is a retired Navy commander. He served two tours in Vietnam. He's a professor of international relations at Boston University. And Dr. Jonathan Shea, thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure to speak with you both.
Dr. Jonathan Shea is author of Odysseus in America, Combat Trauma, and the Trials of Homecoming. A collection of artifacts from civilization's first cities has tragically joined the list of casualties in the war with Iraq. In the chaos following the fall of Baghdad, thousands of treasures from Babylon, Nimrud, and Ur were looted from the National Museum of Iraq. Concerned archaeologists had alerted military leaders of the risks of post-war pillage and the rise of the illicit antiquities trade, but now the museum's shelves are nearly bare. Dr. Paul Zemanski is among that list of scholars. He led digs in Iraq that yielded artifacts for the museum's collection. In this radio diary, Zemanski mourns the loss of these irreplaceable fragments of human history.
I thought a great deal more care was actually being taken before this war than before the Gulf War. And so in this case, there was contact between the military and the State Department and the archaeological community, and numbers of people made this precise warning. Specifically, guard that museum as soon as you can because it's going to be looted. We knew that. And the people we talked to acknowledged the risk, and I thought had taken some steps to prepare for it, but apparently not. I mean, there appears to have been no serious effort made to defend that museum. There were many things in that museum that had not been fully studied. For me, the painful thing is the loss of information. I mean, the pretty objects that are illustrated in the opening chapters of Surveys of History of Art, yeah, it's too bad to have lost those, but that isn't what really hurts as far as I'm concerned. What hurts is knowing, for instance, that we had another edition of the Epic of Gilgamesh that was probably more complete, or at least fill in the holes of the epic. You know, there are many things that we don't know about that epic, and here we had another edition. It was waiting to be published. It's gone now. We've lost that. And there are all the things we will never know about that are in those tablets, particularly the tablets, which were only partially studied, and even when you've studied them once, you need to study them again to recollate and things like that. All that's gone. The other thing that I think is very sad is that this would have been the cornerstone of rebuilding Iraq on some other basis than oil. Iraq's great claim as a country to our attention is that it is the place that had this long history, this very rich sequence of civilizations. For anyone coming to Iraq, the visit to the Baghdad Museum would have been the high point, because that's where all the stuff was. And a lot of it was mundane stuff. It's hard to explain in terms of, people think of an art history museum, and you know, a lot of the stuff in Mesopotamia, frankly, is ugly. It's funny. It's nuanced. And, you know, that's all gone now. I don't think people stealing these things, are, you know, I think most of that stuff is just going to be thrown in the trash. I don't think there's much hope of recovery for most of it. The very famous pieces, I bet we get a few of those very famous pieces back because you can't sell them. And, I mean, they're too famous. And I don't know. There's a certain number of unscrupulous collectors who will savor them in the dark, but eventually I think some of those things will come back. But it's the bulk of the stuff in this society, which was, as ancient worlds go, relatively egalitarian. There wasn't this terrific concentration of wealth in the hands of the few, as there would be, say, in ancient Egypt. This was a place where you could sort of see popular culture at work throughout long swaths of history. What they could have done was so obvious and easy that it hardly bears saying. If they'd sent, you know, one company of soldiers in an armored vehicle, they could have stopped that looting. I think what we can do is everything we possibly can to stop the illegal antiquities trade, to stop those things from leaving Iraq, to make sure that people who were found with antiquities are punished, but perhaps also offer an amnesty for people who have them to return them, and to do what we can to uphold the UNESCO codes that protect against the illegal traffic in antiquities. I'm sure something will be rebuilt. I mean, it's too important not to rebuild it, but there's no doubt that we've lost an enormous amount.
Paul Zemanski, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this